the arhants. An arhant is one who has attained nirvana, and although the Buddha had many lay followers, and several of these achieved high levels of spiritual development, the Buddha's main arhant disciples were monks or nuns. But we must not think of these great beings as bhikkhus and bhikkhunis living in the same way in which we encounter them today in Southeast Asia or even in the West. The Buddha's main disciples were chiefly forest renunciants, tough men and women who took the going forth very seriously indeed. Many of them, before or after they met the Buddha, walked out of lives of privilege and comfort and went into the forest to meditate. Sometime after the Buddha, as the Sangha began to settle down in monasteries and the canonical record began to develop, the lives of the early arhants came to be shown to conform to the archetype of settled monasticism, more or less as we know it today, with shaven-headed monks and nuns wearing spotless cotton or even silk robes, patched in a particular way and worn just so. They were often lavishly supported by a devoted laity and ministered mainly to their religious needs. According to the earliest texts, however, we see that the Buddha's early monastic followers conformed more to the wandering ascetic traditions of their day. They were a ragged and unkempt bunch. The Vinaya prohibits shaving the head or face more than once a fortnight. They wore robes made of roughly stitched pieces of discarded cloth, or even old and sometimes charred cemetery shrouds. They lived on what scraps the villagers offered them, making a point of not begging only from the wealthy. Above all, they were devoted to meditation. The Buddha had many such disciples. Besides the five we find on our tree, there was also Aniruddha, master of the divine eye, who developed supernormal powers through meditation. Mahakashana, master of doctrinal exposition. Angulimala, the serial killer who converted to the Dharma. Ambapali, the former courtesan. Kishagotami, the mother of a child who died. And many, many others. Each had their own particular personality and their own particular strengths. The five arhants on the tree each tell us something distinctive about the Dharma life. Learning their stories and meditating on their qualities, we can learn a great deal about how the spiritual life in its fullness can be lived. They are true exemplars of the life devoted to enlightenment. Shariputra. Because of his deep knowledge and skill in analytical discourse, Shariputra was known as the Marshal of the Dharma. He was also renowned for his kindness to his fellow monks, especially the very young and the old. He was preeminent among the Buddha's chief disciples, but very modest, and his loyalty and deep connection with his childhood friend, Mogliana, has long been an archetype of horizontal spiritual friendship. Shariputra was born into a Brahmin family in the village of Upatissa near Rajagraha. From his earliest childhood, he demonstrated exceptional intelligence. He began formal studies with a teacher at an early age and soon became thoroughly versed in Brahminic knowledge and able to recite the Vedas. His fame spread throughout the region. Near Upatissa lay the village of Kolita, where Mogliana, another gifted child, was born. He and Shariputra were firm friends throughout their childhood. On one occasion, the two friends went along to an annual festival in Rajagriha. Watching everybody's hollow attempts at festivity, Shariputra was filled with a sense of the sad futility of it all. "Sooner or later," he said to his friend, "all these people will be dead. That includes you and me, every one of us. With death hard on our heels, what is the point of wasting time with such distractions?" There and then, he and Mogliana decided to go forth and seek a path of liberation. At that time, philosophers and men of religion were gravitating towards Rajagriha, then the capital of Magadha, one of the largest of the Indian kingdoms. These men were free thinkers who had placed themselves outside the formalistic Brahminical religion of the day. Many of them claimed to teach a path of personal liberation by one means or another. The two friends visited several of these teachers. They were most impressed by the ascetic Sanjaya, who taught an agnostic scepticism and had a following of several hundred disciples, so they decided to follow him. They soon became Sanjaya's leading disciples, owing to their outstanding qualities. But having soon mastered all he had to teach, they realized they'd not yet found the path to liberation and continued to yearn for a true teacher. One day, the Buddha's disciple, Ashvajit, went to beg in Rajagriha, respectfully holding out his alms bowl, comporting himself with a quiet, energetic, modest, and dignified mindfulness. This monk made an enormous impression on Shariputra when he happened to see him pass by. "Perhaps this man has attained the enlightenment I seek," he thought, "or perhaps his teacher has." So he followed Ashvajit, hoping for an opportunity to engage him in conversation. When Ashvajit had finished his alms round and eaten his meal, Shariputra went up to him and made the usual salutations. "Friend," he said, "I am really struck by your appearance. Who are you, and who is your teacher?" "I am Ashvajit," the monk replied, "and I have left home and gone forth to follow the Tathagata, the great enlightened teacher who comes from the land of the Shakyas." "And what is the doctrine of this great enlightened teacher?" Shariputra asked, beginning to tremble with excitement. "I cannot say in detail," Ashvajit replied. "I myself have only quite recently become one of his followers, and I still have a lot to learn." "But please, the main points will be enough," Shariputra responded. Ashvajit pondered for a while, and then, looking straight at the youth, he came out with what was to become one of the most famous utterances in the whole body of Buddhist teaching. Quote, "Of those things that arise from a cause, the Tathagata has told the cause, and also what their cessation is. This is the doctrine of the great recluse." End quote. Shariputra shook when he heard this. In a flash, the truth of the doctrine of dependent origination pervaded his being, and liberating insight flooded his mind. At that moment, he became a stream entrant. Sometime previously, Shariputra and Mogliana had each vowed that if one of them discovered the way to enlightenment before the other, he would seek out his companion to share the teaching with him. True to his word, Shariputra immediately set out to find Mogliana. Seeing him trembling with inspiration as he approached, Mogliana realized that Shariputra had discovered the truth. They spoke for a while, and Mogliana also gained insight. They decided to seek out the Buddha and become his disciples. "But what about all our fellow disciples?" Mogliana asked. "We can't just leave them here. so they decided to tell Sanjaya's other disciples about what they discovered and to leave it to them to decide how best to act. Sanjaya, when he heard this, was distraught. "Please stay," he said. "The three of us can lead this group together." But the friends were adamant and tried to persuade Sanjaya to accompany them. "I couldn't do that," he said. "I'm a great teacher. For me to revert to the state of being a disciple would be as if a huge water tank were to change into a small pitcher." "But a Buddha has appeared in the world," they replied. "Thousands will flock to him for teachings. What will happen to your following then?" "What do you think? Are there more fools in this world or wise people?" Sanjaya asked. "Fools are many, the wise are few," the friends replied. "Let the wise go to the recluse Gotama, the fools will come to me." So together with 500 of Sanjaya's former disciples, the two friends sought out the Buddha to ask to join his Sangha. Seeing them approach, the Buddha instantly recognized their great capacity. "These two friends will become the two great jewels, supreme among my disciples," he said. Shariputra was forever grateful to Ashvajit for having shown him the way, and for the rest of his life, before he lay down to sleep each night, he made 3 deep prostrations in Ashvajit's direction. The two friends often worked together in the service of the Buddha and the Sangha. After the Buddha's ambitious cousin, Devadatta, had created a schism and led 500 young monks away with him to the Vulture's Peak, the Buddha sent Shariputra and Mogliana to win them back. When Devadatta saw them approaching, he assumed they decided to join his faction and welcomed them as his own chief disciples. That evening, while he was resting, the two elders spoke to the assembled monks, led them to stream entry, and persuaded them to return to the Buddha. With his acute intelligence, Shariputra soon developed the reputation of having a highly developed analytical capacity. Indeed, he's credited as the founding father of the Abhidharma approach to spiritual training. But his teaching could also be very simple and direct. An ascetic once came to see him to discuss the spiritual life. "Nirvana," he said. "You followers of the Buddha always go on about Nirvana. What exactly is this Nirvana?" "The end of craving, aversion, and delusion. That is Nirvana," he replied simply. Perhaps because of his association with the later Abhidharma tradition, the Mahayana scriptures often use Shariputra as an icon of a narrow, restricted approach to Dharma practice. The Heart Sutra, for example, in which the fundamental categories of the Abhidharma are shown to have no enduring essence, but are instead ultimately empty, is addressed to Shariputra. But this is a rhetorical device. The real Shariputra was never simply a narrow-minded Hinayanist, nor was he merely a monkish scholar. Once, when he and Mogliana were staying together at Kapottakandra, Shariputra was meditating in the open air on a full moon night, his head freshly shaven. A malicious demon, passing by in a spiteful mood, gave him a severe blow on the head. But Shariputra was so absorbed in meditation that he hardly noticed. Mogliana, with his supernormal powers, observed the whole incident. "Friend, are you comfortable? Are you all right? Does anything trouble you?" he asked. "I am comfortable," Shariputra replied, "but since you ask, I have a slight headache." "That is wonderful," Mogliana exclaimed. "A passing demon dealt you a blow that would have felled an elephant or split a mountain peak, and all you say is that you have a slight headache." "Even more wonderful," replied Shariputra. that you should have seen any demon at all. What great psychic power! I've not even seen as much as a mud sprite. The Buddha, who'd been listening to this discussion with his divine ear, then spoke this inspired utterance in praise of Shariputra. Quote, "Whose mind stands unmoving as a rock, unattached to things that arouse attachment, unangered by things that provoke anger, how can suffering come to one whose mind has been cultivated thus?" End quote. Shariputra was renowned for his generosity and helpfulness. When the other monks made their early morning alms round, he remained behind to tidy up, disposing of refuse and neatly arranging whatever possessions they held in common. Then he would call on any who were sick and make sure they had whatever they needed. When the Buddha went about on foot with a company of monks, Shariputra never walked at the head of the procession, as surely befitted him. Instead, he first attended to the old, the very young, or the unwell, applying oil to any sores they might have on their bodies before leaving together with them. It is said that Shariputra taught with infinite patience. He would admonish, advise, and instruct up to 100 or 1,000 times until his students attained stream entry. The Buddha often praised him for his mastery of the Dharma and his skill in exposition. Quote, "The essence of the Dharma, Dharma Dhatu, has been so well penetrated by Shariputra, O monks, that if I were to question him about it for one day in different words and phrases, Shariputra would reply for one day in various words and phrases. And if I were to question him for one night, or a day and night, or for 2 days and nights, even up to 7 days and nights, Shariputra would expound the matter for the same period of time in various words and phrases." End quote. Towards the end of his life, the Buddha was staying in the Jeta Grove in Shravasti when Shariputra arrived there with a company of followers. After saluting the Buddha, Shariputra told him that the last day of his life on earth had arrived. Would the Buddha permit him to die? The Buddha asked Shariputra whether he had selected any place for his death. "I was born in the village Upatissa in Magadha," Shariputra replied. "The house in which I was born still stands. I would like to die there." "Dear friend, you must do what pleases you," the Lord replied. "Let the Buddha forgive me my faults," said Shariputra. "There is nothing to forgive," said the Buddha, and Shariputra walked away without showing his back to the Buddha. Mogliana. Mogliana was known as the disciple foremost in psychic powers. He was deeply devoted to meditation and to the life of the mind. But he did not confine himself to solitary introspection. He happily shared his dharmic understandings with others and undertook many valuable services for the Buddha and the Sangha. His family had for generations been Brahminical teachers in the service of noble families. They enjoyed wealth and high social status, and when their beloved son, who'd already won great renown locally for his outstanding abilities, decided to adopt the wandering life, they objected fiercely. They had high hopes for the young Mogliana, but being aware of his powerful strength of will and unusual depth of thought, they realised he must have given the matter profound consideration and that his decision was not likely to be revoked. Regretfully, they gave their permission and Mogliana went forth with Shariputra. After joining the Sangha, Mogliana left the bamboo grove for a time and went to stay at the nearby Vulture's Peak. There he took to a cave for meditation. The verses ascribed to him in the Theragatha open with his song in praise of solitary meditation. Quote, "Let us, living in the forest, living on alms food, delighting in whatever scraps come into our alms bowls, tear apart the army of death, being well concentrated inwardly. Let us, living in the forest, living on alms food, delighting in whatever scraps come into our alms bowls, knock down the army of death as an elephant knocks down a reed hut. Let us, living at the foot of a tree, persevering, delighting in whatever scraps come into our alms bowls, tear apart the army of death, being well concentrated inwardly. Let us, living at the foot of a tree, persevering, delighting in whatever scraps come into our alms bowls, knock down the army of death as an elephant knocks down a reed hut." End quote. By exerting great discipline, Mogliana finally attained to the samadhi, where neither thought nor perception occurs. During this period, whenever he became discouraged, Shakyamuni himself would appear in a vision and encourage him to persevere. When Mogliana's efforts finally brought him to complete enlightenment, he said, "I have become enlightened because of my master's teaching and encouragement. I have, therefore, been born of my master." From then on, he was able to establish communication with the Buddha no matter what distance separated them. Once, when the Buddha went off to the Jeta Grove at Shravasti, and while Shariputra and Mogliana were staying at the bamboo grove in Rajagraha, Mogliana turned to Shariputra and reported a conversation he'd just had with the Buddha. "But how could you have spoken with him when he was so far away, beyond many mountains and rivers?" asked Shariputra. "It's not that I miraculously transported myself to his side," replied Mogliana, "or that he came to mine, but somehow, using supernormal senses, I spoke to him and he replied, urging me to be diligent. All the followers of the Dharma should respect you," said Shariputra. "We should remain close to you and make every effort to become like you, just as the small stone nearby resembles the great Himalaya mountains." Mogliana, for his part, often praised Shariputra. "Your teachings are like food to the hungry and water to the thirsty," he once told him, after Shariputra had given teachings on the four ways to liberation. Shakyamuni himself was unstinting in his praises of the two. Quote, "Cultivate the friendship of Shariputra and Mogliana, bhikkhus. Associate with Shariputra and Mogliana. They are wise and helpful to their companions in the holy life. Shariputra is like a mother. Mogliana is like a nurse. Shariputra trains others for the fruit of stream entry. Mogliana for the supreme goal." End quote. Shariputra often brought beginners to the point of stream entry. He then handed them over to Mogliana, who trained them for arhantship. Mogliana always put his supernormal powers at the service of the Dharma. He visited various Devalokas for the sake of teaching, and the Buddha sometimes called upon his peculiar gifts. Once, when the Buddha was staying on the upper story of a building in Shravasti, and a crowd of monks were talking loosely and loudly on the ground floor, he asked Mogliana to shake the building with his big toe to quieten them down. Mogliana was always very outspoken, and as he proclaimed the Buddha's Dharma, he fearlessly exposed wrong views whenever he encountered them. This earned him the enmity of followers of rival teachers. especially of a group of naked ascetics who believed he had won their followers over with reports of his celestial travels, in which he apparently related that he had seen the Buddha's followers enjoying rebirth in divine realms, while the followers of other sects, owing to their lack of moral conduct, suffered in miserable subhuman realms. They decided to eliminate him. Having acquired 1,000 gold coins from their followers, they offered them to a band of thugs in exchange for Mogliana's life. Using his psychic powers, Mogliana evaded the hired killers for 7 days. Seeing them coming, he would slip through the keyhole of his hut or escape through the roof. Although he had no fear of death, he did not want them to suffer the karmic consequences of killing him. But the killers were both greedy and persistent, and one day, because of the ripening of a karma from a past life, Mogliana's psychic powers suddenly deserted him. The killers entered his hut and pounded his bones until they were as small as grains of rice. Thinking he was dead, they fled to claim their reward, but they'd not reckoned with Mogliana's formidable psychic powers, which had now returned. By the power of his meditation, he soared through the air and came to the Buddha. There he announced that the time had come for him to die. The Buddha asked him to give a final discourse to the assembled monks, which he did, displaying many wonders and marvels. Then he returned to his abode and passed into Nirvana. Ananda. For the last 25 years of the Buddha's life, his cousin Ananda was his close companion. According to the Buddha, Ananda was preeminent in 5 qualities. He was the best of the Buddha's attendants. He was foremost among those who had heard much. He had the best memory, the greatest mastery of the sequential structure of the teachings, and he was most steadfast in study. He was much loved in the Sangha, to whom he devoted most of his life. Ananda and his brother Aniruddha were Shakyan aristocrats, born in the town of Kapilavastu. Amritadhana, their father, was the brother of the Buddha's father, Suddhodana, although they probably had different mothers. When Ananda was 37, the two brothers, together with several other Shakyan nobles, went forth and joined the Buddha's Sangha. During Ananda's first rains retreat, the venerable Puna Mantaniputta gave the assembled novices a teaching on the relationship between the notion I am and the 5 skandhas. Hearing this, Ananda gained stream entry. For the next 18 years, he happily passed his time in the Sangha, purifying his mind, strengthening his practice, and getting on with his fellow monks. Ananda was renowned for his sweet, companionable nature. When he and the Buddha were both 55 years old, however, a momentous change in the pattern of his life occurred. The Buddha called a meeting of his monk disciples. In my 20 years as leader of the Sangha, he said, I have had many different attendants, but none of them has really filled the post perfectly. Again and again, some willfulness has become apparent. Now I am old and I need a trustworthy, reliable attendant. At once, all the leading disciples offered their services, but the Buddha accepted none of them. Ananda alone held back. Why are you holding back? They asked. Shouldn't you also volunteer? Although he would have liked to have been his revered cousin's attendant, he was too modest to put himself forward. In any case, he was confident the Buddha would know whom to choose. The Buddha was aware what Ananda was thinking. Ananda would be pleasing to me, he said, and so began a close companionship that lasted until the death of the Buddha. Realizing that some of the disciples were likely to accord him special status because he was always at the Buddha's side, Ananda saw that he would have to be discreet if he was to avoid jealousy, and that he would have to take special care to avoid pride. He also realized he would have to be sure never to stray from the Dharma if he was to live up to his new task. He therefore asked the Buddha to allow certain conditions to be met if he were to undertake his new duty. Because he did not want people to think he was serving the Buddha out of desire for material gain, he asked that the Buddha should never give him any of the food he received, nor any of the robes. He insisted that he should never be given any special accommodation, nor should he be included in the personal invitations to hospitality that the Buddha received. On the other hand, he asked that if he himself was invited to a meal, he could transfer the invitation to the Buddha. If people from outlying areas came to see the Buddha, he wanted the privilege of introducing them. And if he had any doubts about the Dharma, he asked that he should be able to talk to the Buddha about them at any time. Finally, if the Buddha gave a discourse in his absence, he would agree to repeat it later in his presence. The Buddha gladly agreed to these conditions. Ananda was a very popular man, much loved by everybody who got to know him, and he had many spiritual friends, including, of course, the Buddha himself. He was once staying with the Buddha at Sakara, a Shakyan village, and reflecting on the joy and efficacy of spiritual friendship. "Lord, I've been thinking," he told the Buddha. "You know, spiritual friendship seems to me to be half the spiritual life." "Don't say that, Ananda, don't say that," the Buddha replied. "Spiritual friendship is the whole of the spiritual life." Ananda, who had a prodigious memory and spent much of his time with the Buddha, was consequently very learned in the Dharma. A lay disciple once asked the Buddha how, after he'd honoured the Buddha and the Sangha, he might honour the Dharma. This was in an age when the Buddha's teaching had not yet been written down. "If you wish to honour the Dharma," replied the Buddha, "go and honour Ananda, the guardian of the Dharma." So this disciple invited Ananda to a meal and gave him some valuable cloth. Ananda offered this to Shariputra, who in turn gave it to the Buddha, for he alone was the cause of all bliss. On another occasion, after Ananda had answered a question from some monks and then left the assembly, the Buddha turned to the monks and said, "Ananda is still on the path of higher training. Yet it is not easy to find one who equals him fully in wisdom." Ananda's qualities fitted him for the special role of guardian of the Dharma, or Dharma Bandhagarika. Within a political state, the Bandhagarika is the treasurer with responsibility for storing, protecting, and dispensing the national wealth. If he is inept or irresponsible, revenue will decline and the state may become bankrupt. If he is astute, national wealth will be used wisely and there'll be peace and prosperity. In the Buddha's dispensation, wealth is the Dharma, and especially after the Buddha's death, the life and health of the Buddha's dispensation required that the Dharma be carefully preserved and faithfully passed on for posterity. The post of treasurer of the Dharma was therefore of immense importance, to the extent that one who held it could rightly call himself the eye of the entire world, as Ananda does in his Theragatha verses. Quote, If one wishes to understand the Dhamma, one should resort to such a one, who is of great learning, a bearer of the Dharma, a wise disciple of the Buddha. Of great learning, bearer of the Dhamma, the guardian of the great seer's treasure. He is the eye of the entire world, deserving worship, of great learning. End quote. As a child, the Buddha had been brought up by his aunt, Maha Prajapati. After her brother, Suddhodana, died, Maha Prajapati decided she wanted to join the Sangha, and since the Buddha was then visiting Kapilavastu, his former hometown, Maha Prajapati approached him and requested 3 times that she be allowed to join the Sangha. But each time the Buddha refused because she was a woman. He then left Kapilavastu and made for Vaishali, several hundred miles away. Maha Prajapati and several other Shakyan women decided that they would go forth and followed close behind. Arriving at the hall of the peaked gable where the Buddha was staying, Maha Prajapati stood outside the porch, her feet swollen, her limbs covered with dust, with tearful face and crying. Seeing her piteous state, Ananda decided to intercede on her behalf. He went to the Buddha and repeated Maha Prajapati's request 3 times, but each time the Buddha discouraged him. Ananda then decided to use an indirect method. Suppose women were to go forth from home into the homeless life under the Dhamma Vinaya set forth by the Tathagata, he asked. Would they be capable of attaining the fruits of stream entry, or the fruit of once returning, or the fruit of non-returning, or the fruit of arhantship? The Buddha admitted that women were indeed so capable, and Ananda seized his chance. Maha Prajapati was of great service to the Buddha when he was an infant, he told him. She actually suckled him after the death of his mother. This alone would be a good reason for him now to help her gain final liberation. Unable to resist this argument, the Buddha agreed to the establishment of the nuns' order, providing certain rules were followed. From that time, Ananda has always held a special place in the affections of the nuns' sangha. Ananda's relationship to the Buddha was not just that of servant. He was a friend, companion and secretary, and there was great warmth and intimacy between them. He brought the Buddha water for washing his face and a tooth stick for cleaning his teeth. He arranged his seat, washed his feet, massaged his back, fanned him, swept his cell and repaired his robes. He slept by him, always to be on hand in case anything was needed. He accompanied the Buddha on his rounds of the monks' precincts and always checked to see whether monks had left anything behind after meetings. He carried the Buddha's messages and called the monks together if the Buddha wanted to talk with them, sometimes even at midnight. When the Buddha was sick, he got medicine for him, and once, when a monk had fallen ill with dysentery and was neglected by his fellows, the Buddha and Ananda washed him and carried him to a resting place. Ananda played a large part in facilitating the Buddha's communication with a growing Sangha. When there was a quarrel between the monks at Kosambi and when Devadatta brought about a schism, Ananda helped people clarify their doubts and renew their communication with one another. He was often the go-between for the monks, arranging their interviews with the Buddha, and he took the Buddha's words to the leaders of other sects. Refusing no one, Ananda thought of himself as a bridge rather than a barrier. Quote, "For 25 years I served the Blessed One. I served him well with loving deeds, like a shadow that does not depart. For 25 years I served the Blessed One. I served him well with loving speech, like a shadow that does not depart. For 25 years I served the Blessed One. I served him well with loving thoughts, like a shadow that does not depart. End quote. When the Buddha was preparing to die, Ananda became deeply distressed. He went to his lodging and stood lamenting, leaning on the doorpost. Alas, I am still a learner with much to do, and the teacher is passing away, who was so compassionate to me. The Buddha noticed Ananda was missing and sent a monk to call him. When Ananda arrived, the Buddha consoled him, telling him that since all compounded things are subject to decay, how could he not die? Then he encouraged and praised him. For a long time, Ananda, you have been in the Tathagata's presence, showing loving kindness in act of body, speech and mind, beneficially, blessedly, wholeheartedly and unstintingly. You have achieved much merit, Ananda. Make the effort, and in a short time you will be free of the corruptions. Then the Buddha addressed the monks. He told them that all the Buddhas of the past had an attendant like Ananda, as would Buddhas of the future, and he told them Ananda was always wise. He knew the right time for monks, nuns, and lay followers to come and see the Buddha, and for kings, royal ministers, for leaders of other schools and their pupils. Moreover, he told them, Ananda has four remarkable and wonderful qualities. What are they? If a company of monks comes to see Ananda, they are pleased at the sight of him. And when Ananda talks Dharma to them, they are pleased. And when he is silent, they are disappointed. And so it is too with nuns, and with male and female lay followers. After the Buddha's parinirvana, Ananda went off to the forest to meditate, but when it became known to the villagers that the Buddha's personal attendant was nearby, he was inundated with visitors. The Buddha, Shariputra, Mogliana, and the just king, Pasenadi, had all died that year. People felt a strong need for consolation, and Ananda, characteristically, responded to their need. In consequence, he was rarely alone. Then a deva, who lived in the forest, appeared and spoke to him. Quote, having entered the thicket at the foot of a tree, having placed Nibbana in your heart, meditate, Gotama, and be not negligent. What will this hullabaloo do for you? End quote. Ananda responded to this exhortation with a renewed sense of urgency. In the meantime, Mahakashyapa had decided to call a council to regularize the contents of the Buddha's Dharma. Since Ananda knew most of the discourses, he was indispensable to the council. Yet of all the 500 monks invited, he was the only one who was not yet an arhant. As the date of the council drew near, Aniruddha suggested that Ananda should be admitted only if he could overcome the last of the defilements and attain arhantship. Aniruddha clearly knew what he was doing, for Ananda now applied all his effort to spiritual practice. He practiced the four foundations of mindfulness throughout the night, and in the early hours, just as he was lying down to sleep, his mind was finally released from all the cankers. The council was about to begin. No sooner were all the monks seated than Ananda arrived, flying through the air by his psychic power, and took his seat. On the basis of Ananda's recollections, the anthologies that make up the Sutta Pitaka were settled. When Ananda was 120 years old, he realized his end was near, So he planned a journey from Rajagaha to Vaishali, just as the Buddha had done. When the king of Magadha and the princes of Vaishali heard of this, they hurried from both directions to bid him farewell. In order to do justice to both sides, Ananda raised himself into the air by his psychic powers and allowed the fire element to consume his body. His relics were then divided and stupas erected. It was typical of Ananda's gentle skillfulness that any quarrel over his funeral rites and remains was thus avoided. Kashyapa. Kashyapa was a formidable ascetic, devoted to solitary meditation, but his early life did little to prepare him for the hardships he willingly embraced after meeting the Buddha. Born into a wealthy Brahmin family in Magadha, Kashyapa led a pampered early life. Observing how little joy he took in secular life, fearful that he would soon go forth, and anxiously desiring an heir, his parents continually pressed him to marry. In the end, to escape their constant importunity, he had a goldsmith make an exquisitely beautiful and noble female form from pure gold. "I'll marry when you can find me a girl like this," he told them. His parents searched the land and in due course actually found a maiden, Badar Kapilani, who resembled the statue. She and Kashyapa were duly wed. But she also harboured strong spiritual desires, and they both remained celibate. After the death of Kashyapa's parents, he and his wife put on ochre robes, cut off each other's hair, and taking up their begging bowls, abandoned the household life together. At the first crossroads they came to, Kashyapa took the right turn and she the left, and so they parted. Badar made her way to Shravasti, where she joined the Bhikkhuni Sangha, became an arhant, and devoted herself to the education of the younger nuns. When Kashyapa and Badar had parted, the earth trembled through the force of their renunciation. Perceiving this, the Buddha realized that it meant an outstanding disciple was on his way, and he set out to meet his future pupil. Some way along the road, he took his seat beneath the banyan tree and waited, his aura lighting up the area. When Kashyapa saw the Buddha sitting there in his glory, he realized at once that this man was the teacher for him, and he fell prostrate at his feet. "The Blessed One, Lord, is my teacher, and I'm his disciple. The Blessed One, Lord, is my teacher, and I'm his disciple," he exclaimed. The Buddha accepted him as a disciple and gave him 3 rules of training. Quote, "You should train yourself thus, Kashyapa, a keen sense of shame and fear of wrongdoing. Hiri Otapa shall be present in me towards seniors, novices, and those of middle status in the order. Whatever teaching I hear that is conducive to something wholesome, I shall listen with an attentive ear, examining it, reflecting on it, absorbing it with all my heart. Mindfulness of the body linked with gladness shall not be neglected by me. Thus should you train yourself." End quote. Kashyapa then took off his fine robe and made a seat for the Buddha. The Buddha commented on the softness of the fine cloth. "Please take it, you must have it," Kashyapa replied. "But what will you wear?" asked the Buddha. "May I be so bold as to beg my master's robe?" asked Kashyapa. "But it is old and worn and made of nothing but old scraps of cloth. Can you really wear it?" asked the Buddha. "I will prize it beyond all things," said Kashyapa, and so they exchanged robes. Conscious of the great honour the Buddha had bestowed upon him, Kashyapa took upon himself the Dutta Gunas, a set of particularly austere ascetic practices which he followed for the rest of his life. Thus he undertook only to wear patched robes and never to own more than three of them, to live only on alms, not to omit any house on his alms round, no matter how poor or abusive its occupants, to eat only at one sitting and only from the alms bowl, refusing all other food, to live in a forest or under a tree or in the open air or in a charnel ground, to be satisfied with whatever dwelling he found, and to sleep always in an upright position instead of lying down. Not long after his ordination, Kāshyapa gained enlightenment, but he continued to practice the Dutta Gunas.
And only for his own sake, he said, but also as an example to others. In the Theragatha, he tells this story. One day he came down from the mountain to make an alms round. In the street he saw a leper eating his meal and courteously stopped at his side. The leper, with his leprous hand, put a morsel into Kāshyapa's bowl, but as he threw it in, one of his fingers broke off and fell into the food. In accordance with his vows, Kāshyapa sat at a wall nearby and ate his meal. And I felt no disgust then or after, for those who take things as they come, living on scraps and using only cow's urine for medicine, taking rags from refuse heaps for their robes and living at the foot of a tree, truly they are contented everywhere. Kāshyapa is also regarded as the second patriarch of all the Chan and Zen schools. Once, when the Buddha was staying at the Vulture's Peak, he sat with a large gathering of disciples waiting for him to teach. In complete silence, the Buddha simply held up a golden flower and sat there quietly, not saying a word. Kāshyapa alone understood the meaning of this and quietly smiled at the Buddha. I have the most precious spiritual treasure, Kāshyapa, which at this moment I hand over to you, said the Buddha. Thus began the special transmission outside the scriptures. Kāshyapa lived to a great age, eventually presiding over the first council that was held after the Buddha's death. By the time he died, it is said, he had not lain on a bed for 120 years. Despite his great asceticism, his life was filled with joy and ascetic delight. In the Theragatha, he sang in praise of solitary meditation. Quote, spread over with gareri garlands, these regions are delightful to my heart, resounding with elephants so lovely, those rocky mountains give me delight. The splendid hue of dark blue clouds, where streams are flowing cool and clear, covered with Indagopaka insects, these rocky mountains give me delight. Like towering peaks of dark blue clouds, like lofty houses with gabled roofs, resounding with elephants so lovely, those rocky mountains give me delight. Their lovely surfaces lashed by rain, the mountains are resorted to by seers, echoing with the cries of peacocks, those rocky mountains give me delight. There is enough for me desiring to meditate, enough for me, resolute and mindful. There is enough for me, a bhikkhu, resolute, desirous of the goal. This is enough for me, desiring comfort, a bhikkhu with a resolute mind. This is enough for me, desiring exertion, a stable one of resolute mind. They are like the blue blossoms of flax, like autumn sky covered with clouds, with flocks of many kinds of birds, those rocky mountains give me delight. No crowds of lay folk visit these hills, but they are inhabited by herds of deer, with flocks of many kinds of birds. Those rocky mountains give me delight. Wide gorges are there, where clear water flows, haunted by monkeys and by deer, covered by wet carpets of moss. Those rocky mountains give me delight. The music of a five-piece ensemble can never give me so much delight as I derive when, with one pointed mind, I gain proper insight into the Dhamma. End quote. Dharma Dinner. The Buddha thought of Dharma Dinner as the foremost teacher of the Dharma among the nuns. We do not know much about her life, but her teaching, particularly on the spiral and cyclical nature of conditioned existence, has played a large part in the development of Sangharakshita's thought. Before going forth, she had been the wife of Vishakha, a wealthy citizen of Rajagraha and a close friend of King Bimbisara. One day her husband went to visit the new teacher, Shakyamuni, who was then staying at the bamboo grove. And after listening to his discourse, he became a non-returner. On hearing this, Dharmadina decided that she too wished to renounce the world and strive for enlightenment. Respecting her intentions, Visakha sent her to join the community of nuns in a golden palanquin provided by his friend the king. There she resolved to take up the spiritual life in earnest and took herself off to the remote countryside where she practiced intensively and soon became an arhant. When Dharmadina returned to the bamboo grove to spend time with the Buddha, Visakha went to see her, curious to find out what his former wife had made of her intensive practice. The Kula Vidala Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya recounts the story of their meeting. Visakha questioned Dharmadina very closely. To begin with, perhaps, he didn't take her very seriously. Maybe he was just testing to see if she'd really learnt anything. Very soon, however, it became clear that she was in fact instructing him, and he followed her words intently. He began by asking her about the nature of the self. What does it comprise, and how does it come to be? She told him that it comprises the five skandhas, that it comes into being as a result of our craving, and that it ceases when we stop craving. Quote, "Lady, personality, personality," is said. "What is called personality by the Blessed One?" "Friend Visakha, these five aggregates affected by clinging are called personality by the Blessed One. That is, the material form aggregate affected by clinging, the feeling aggregate affected by clinging, the perception aggregate affected by clinging, the formations aggregate affected by clinging, and the consciousness aggregate affected by clinging. These five aggregates affected by clinging are called personality by the Blessed One." Saying, "Good lady," the lay follower Visakha, delighted and rejoiced in the bhikkhuni Dharmadina's words, then he asked her a further question. "Lady, origin of personality, origin of personality," is said. "What is called the origin of personality by the Blessed One?" "Friend Visakha, it is craving, which brings renewal of being, is accompanied by delight and lust, and delights in this and that. That is, craving for sensual pleasures, craving for being, and craving for non-being. This is called the origin of personality by the Blessed One. She then expounded the Eightfold Path as the means to bring about the cessation of craving, and in passing showed how the eight limbs of the path correspond to the threefold way. The path of ethics, she explained, corresponds to the practices of right speech, right action, and right livelihood. The path of meditation corresponds to right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. The path of wisdom corresponds to right vision and right emotion. Their discussion covered many abstruse topics. Eventually, and perhaps most importantly, it concluded with Dharma Dinner outlining two fundamental tendencies within conditioned existence. There is a cyclical tendency, she told him, in which pleasant feelings simply give way to painful ones. Painful feelings give way to pleasant ones, and neutral feelings give way to ignorance. And there is a spiral tendency in which ignorance instead gives way to true knowledge. True knowledge gives way to liberation, and liberation gives way to nirvana. Quote, "Lady, what is the counterpart of pleasant feeling? Friend Visakha, painful feeling is the counterpart of pleasant feeling. What is the counterpart of painful feeling? Pleasant feeling is the counterpart of painful feeling. What is the counterpart of neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Ignorance is the counterpart of neither painful nor pleasant feeling. What is the counterpart of ignorance? True knowledge is the counterpart of ignorance. What is the counterpart of true knowledge? Deliverance is the counterpart of true knowledge. What is the counterpart of deliverance? Nibbana is the counterpart of deliverance." End quote. There is, in other words, a samsaric, cyclic, or reactive tendency within conditioned existence, where states simply pass over into their opposites, and there's also a nirvanic, creative, or spiral tendency in which positive mental states can increasingly be augmented. "And what does nirvana give way to?" asks Visakha. "You have pushed this line of questioning too far," replied Dharmadina. "You have not seen that there is a limit to such questions. The spiritual life culminates in nirvana, and that is its end. If you like, go to the Buddha and ask him. Then remember what he tells you." Pleased with what he'd heard from his former wife, Visakha went to the Buddha and recounted their conversation. "Dharmadina is truly wise, Visakha," the Buddha told him. "If you had asked me any of those questions, I should have explained it all to you in the same way. You should remember what she has said." This is a rare example of a female disciple's teaching being given the status of Buddha Vachana, the word of the Buddha. By stating that he would have taught things in exactly the same way, the Buddha gave Dharmadina's teaching the stamp of canonical authenticity. Dharmadina's verses in the Theragata also echo those of the Buddha. She took his verses, which appear in the Dhammapada, and transposed them into the feminine gender. "Eager for the end of suffering, full of awareness, that's the way. When one's heart is not attached to pleasure, we say, that woman has entered the stream." End of chapter.